Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining me today is renowned photographer John Stanmeyer, born in Illinois. John Stanmeyer is a founding member of the Seven Photo Agency. Living in the Far East for over 12 years, Stanmeyer has witnessed nearly every historical event in Asia, photographing the rapid changes taking place through the entire region. Working globally, he has focused on the plight of refugees from the Ugandan Civil War, spent months chronicling the effects of the 2004 tsunami, and documented the mental health care crisis in Asia. Prior to moving to Hong Kong in 1996, Stanmeyer covered the conflict in South Sudan, Eastern European social change after the fall of communism, as well as numerous visits to Haiti to record the endless social tragedies plaguing the island nation. For over 8 years, he has documented the spread of HIV/AIDS through every country in Asia. Stanmeyer's focus is on social injustices, eradication of global poverty, human rights, and raising awareness for the sustaining vanishing cultures. Working regularly for National Geographic magazine, John was on contract with Time magazine for over 10 years and photographing for numerous other global publications. Stanmeyer has been the recipient of numerous honors, including the prestigious Robert Capa Award, named Magazine Photographer of the Year, awarded numerous World Press Picture of the Year and NPPA Awards, and in 2008 received the National Magazine Award for this in-depth essay on the global malaria epidemic. John has published a number of books, including Island of the Spirits, a journalistic anthropologic look at the Balinese culture during the 5 years he lived on the island. His latest book, Seven Photo Agency Collaboration, titled Questions Without Answers, was released in 2012. When not on assignment with National Geographic, Stanmeyer spends time in his gallery, located in the historic 174-year-old Shaker Dam House along the Williams River, a venue where he leverages the power of photography with the brilliance of coffee and tea, united for the advancement of social change, education outreach, and liquid illumination. Stanmeyer lives with his wife, Anastasia Stanmeyer, editor of Berkshire Magazine, and their three children on a farm in the Berkshires of Weston, Massachusetts. You can find out more and see John's work at www.johnstanmeyer, that's J-O-H-N Stanmeyer, one word, S-T-A-N-M-E-Y-E-R.com. Welcome, John Stanmeyer. Love your coffee house. Time to talk.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you.
You've done an awful lot in a very short life so far. Let's start with where you grew up and what got you interested in being so fearless.
Well, I was born in Illinois, and then I grew up in the Bahamas. My father was a banker and was transferred overseas to run a bank when I was a kid. And so I grew up in Nassau, New Providence.
What was that like?
It was very comforting and welcoming. I lived in among the community. My best friend was Andy Adams. His father was a musician in a Bahamian sort of reggae band. We used to climb up canep trees and collect caneps, little tiny small type of fruit with a seed in it, and we'd sell them on the side of the road, build little wooden go-karts, and scoot down a hill, although Nassau isn't really a hilly place. It really, in hindsight now, it was very, very magical. But it's all part of sort of the evolutionary upbringing that myself or any one of us have ever had, you know, growing up as human.
What did your father, the banker, think of your enterprise, climbing trees?
He seemed to have enjoyed it. I guess because he was into finance, he probably saw me as doing some sort of macro finance and, you know, business planning. But, you know, I don't remember. He worked so much. I did see him, of course, but I didn't see him as much as I would see my mother, let's say.
What about school? Where did you go? What did you do?
I went to school at a school called St. Andrews in Nassau. And then there was a point when my father wanted us to go learn more about American history. My father had fought both in World War II and the Korean War as a pilot. So he was quite, I wouldn't say he was overly patriotic, but he was a very proud American and had given a lot for his country. And there was a point I can vaguely remember of him saying, you know, I want, as much as it's great to learn about British history and British society and British governance, maybe we should send you up to the U.S. to go to school there. And he continued to work in the Bahamas, and he would fly back in the beginning only once every 2 months. I remember that was a very difficult time to notice that he wasn't around. I'll never forget his first time leaving. I was absolutely gutted. I didn't quite understand what it meant to not have a father around, but my parents loved each other. They weren't divorced or anything, but he did it for the betterment of the family. And then I went to another school.
Well, wait a second now. St. Andrews was in
Nassau. And then ironically, I went to another school called St. Andrews, of all things, in Boca Raton, Florida. No connection. You know, I didn't have any choice in any of this stuff. Your parents send it to you and you just wing it. And
the siblings?
I have two half-brothers, a half-sister. My mother was married before. And then I have one full sister, but she passed away.
Oh.
So I've sort of pretty much just been by myself. I also lived a bit of time in Hawaii. My brother, my half-brother, ran a hotel, spent about 4 or 5 months there. If there's anything to try to answer your question, I don't know if I'm fearless.
Well, you've been in a lot of places I wouldn't be.
Yeah, but I wouldn't also want to cross certain, you know, busy streets in major cities either. In many ways, I actually find it not as problematic as it may seem, although it is uncomfortable. A lot of my colleagues have not made it home. To maybe try to answer your question, what the driving force might be is that my mother was Viennese, an Austrian immigrant, and we would go to Europe, not all the time, but at least a few times as a child. And there was always a sort of global approach to the way my family functioned and thought.
Did you find anything interesting about the Austrian culture?
You know, actually, tragically, I didn't. I wish I had. Now, in hindsight, I didn't want to learn German or Austrian or Viennese. I don't know why. I can't remember why. And then I went back to Austria a few times. I used to live in Europe.
Is this where your father met your mother?
No, they met as pen pals. They wrote letters to each other, and he fell in love with her, and she fell in love with him by writing letters. And then he flew to Vienna, if I have the story correct, met her at the train station, and within a few days, they got married.
Really?
Yeah.
And he was a pilot. He was bombing those countries.
He was in World War. I don't know actually what he did or what he flew. He never talked about the war. He never, ever put it in our face or overly mentioned it. He was very reserved about it. I don't know if it's because if he saw too much. I really don't know. He never shared it, both in World War II and Korea. He never shared it.
Okay, so then did you go to college?
I went to an art school in Florida, the Art Institute. I used to actually be a fashion photographer in a past life. I really much call it a past life. And I moved to Europe right out of college, right out of art school in the early 80s and went to Milan and started working. It was very difficult in the beginning. And then I started to work quite a bit with Harper's Bazaar and Italian Vogue.
I'm sorry, John, when did you first pick up a camera?
I didn't pick up a camera until coming back from Hawaii. I was about 17. But I had to connect back to it maybe a little bit. My father had a camera, an old Nikon F something or another, and he let me tinker with it, and he never pushed me about it. It was always there, or it was ubiquitous in the house, although it was my mother who was the chief photographer, it seemed, in the family, and she just used a little Instamatic. I ended up realizing that after my father died, started digging through some boxes, and he had a Leica, he had Nikons, he had a, you know, Rolleiflex 6x6 camera. He obviously had an interest in photography well beyond what I would have ever imagined that I ever showed. He never put it on me. My parents never told me what I should be. They let me decide through life what I wanted to be or what I should do. And then I stumbled into another box with a whole bunch of photographs of his, Kodachrome, black and white, 8mm films that he took during the war of his travels throughout the west of the U.S., all done with Leicas. And, you know, I just, oh, my God, this was my father. And maybe, I have no idea, he died so long ago now, or at least it seems, in 1996.
How old was he?
He was 73. He had Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And my mother died about 10 years afterwards in 2002. It was a tragic event. I was in northern Sumatra when it happened and was racing to get home, and I missed her passing by about 8 hours. But in general, I think life sort of dictated what I do. Again, but very much so in a way where we're in art school. I was drawn by the art of photography and the limitless potential of what my mind could conceive and then put
into
film.
Did you have a mentor?
You know, it was fashion photographers. It was art fashion photographers. Helmut Newton, Arthur Elgort, Peter Lindbergh. I mean, people that maybe you don't know. Or it's in. I call my business of photography and definitely photo, you know, journalism, the cave. Yeah. We think we know everyone in it and everybody pays attention to it, but in reality, we're all in a cave. Outside of the cave, nobody knows anything about it. And I think that's actually great. But in many ways, I have no inspirations on the photojournalism side.
What about the women? I mean, that's the first thing that would pop into my mind. Your fashion photographer and around all those beautiful women. How did that affect you?
Didn't have any, I wouldn't say I didn't have any interest per se, but I actually mostly photograph men.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I was more intrigued by storytelling in fashion.
What do you mean?
I never worked in a studio, although I can. I know how to do it, but I don't have an interest in it. It was street fashion reportage. I would do a story, come up with an idea. They'd act it out for me. I'd actually almost have it not scripted on paper, but I'd have it in my mind. And
can you
I'd
remember any
out.
Of it?
A lot of screaming and yelling and covering bodies in dirt and making clothing out of the clothing that was either presented or out of toilet paper and bed sheets. I was intrigued by a trip to Tunisia for Christmas in, my goodness, it was the year that Reagan was either bombing or doing something in Libya. I just remember we were near the border of Libya, and we were having difficulties. Hotel room was searched and whatnot. Anyways, passports were taken. But I was very intrigued by mirrors and reflections. And that was really actually a turning point for me from fashion photography and into reality. It was a moment of massive awakening, literally an epiphany, to the reality that my mind could conceive almost anything and I can create it. It almost became too simple, but I was too blind by the enormity and the power of the majesty around me, which was reality. And in art school, I had 3 semesters of photojournalism, and I failed every semester of photojournalism.
What do you mean you failed?
Well, they just squeaked me through. The professor, teacher, photographer, Mr. Clark, sort of let me go through because he realized, and I graduated with what was called best portfolios or high honors, but ironically, nothing related to photojournalism. And it wasn't until a series of events in my life, like the trip to Tunisia and then a trip to New York while working for Interview Magazine, that I was wandering around the streets of Manhattan. I was going to go to Times Square for New Year's. I don't remember the year it was, 84 maybe, 85. And I was walking back to the hotel and I saw these fellow human beings sitting on a heater grid. And I just was drawn to them. And I sat with them, homeless men and women, and spent the whole night there. Couldn't leave. Just was absolutely mesmerized by their stories, by who they were. They're no different than I was. And they were staying at a place called the Hot Spot. They called it the Hot Spot. And that was really the final, the railing had broken, and I realized the magnitude of what I wasn't paying attention to.
You taking pictures during that time?
I didn't. I drew. I had a journal, and I drew while I was lying there and spending the night with these people. I was a photographer. I was in New York. I was living in Milan, flying into New York, doing for Interview Magazine, which was a very intriguing time while Warhol was still alive.
Did you know him?
I met him at a party and met him in the office, but not heavily socializing, no. I never really fit into that scene, I think, was the other element, is that I was in it. I could have stayed with it. I could have, you know, if you want to make money, you don't want to do journalism. You want to do commercial advertising and, in some regards, fashion that leads into advertising or what have you. But there was a turning point that I realized that I was too blind to see the enormous power of and brilliance and the art of reality that was right before me. And luckily, I was young enough. I caught myself at a young enough age, I probably was about 23, 24, that I just threw it all away. I went back to Italy, spent a few more months, and just grew fed up of it. I just thought, what am I doing? Where am I sending my life to? I'd probably be dead by now if I was still doing that line of work.
What do you say?
It's just a very fast, different life. It was also a bit overly mental for me to stretch my mind too far, so to speak. I'll just put it that way.
Did you ever approach a breakdown?
Yes, have. And I literally left Italy with just 2 bags, my camera, and moved to Spain and went to Madrid. And it was then that I started to do street photography. And I lived in a hotel, actually, right on Plaza Mayor, right in the heart of old Madrid. And it was a very interesting time. Madrid was very intense at that time. I went back a few years later, and it had become quite gentrified. But it was that time that I really started to realize sort of the enormity and beauty of street photography. And actually, now when I think about it, I met these Peace Corps volunteers. That was right, yeah. And I was absolutely mesmerized by their tale. And they were, ironically, because I ended up spending, and still do at times, spend a lot of time in Haiti, they were Peace Corps workers in Haiti. And I thought, my goodness, this is what I want to do. I want to go dig ditches. I want to go and, you know, make latrines and find a way to do something that was actually purposeful. And I literally just said, forget this photography. Enough is enough. It was leading me down an endlessly creative path, but it was all about myself. It wasn't about the other elements that were finally manifesting themselves clearly that I was noticing in life. And I went back stateside, applied for the Peace Corps, and was rejected because I didn't have a degree in engineering or teaching. I had a degree in art. Of course, now I've run into Peace Corps workers all over the world, and you know, now like, oh my goodness, they'll take you right away. You know, just somebody who's passionate about it. But at the time, in the 80s, they were really looking for people who could learn how to do proper latrine building and whatnot.
Let's get a couple of things straight. John Stanmeyer, how old are you?
I'm almost 50, 49.
Okay, so you're a kid. Still a kid.
Oh, totally a kid. Yeah. I'm 12.
Okay, well, compared to me. Okay, so...
You look good, though.
Thank you. Because I think when people are listening to this kind of thing, they want to reference when you say back in the 80s. It seems like yesterday to me.
Oh, it does. Absolutely. It's a sliver of hair on our head.
Yeah.
It's nothing.
Okay, so I want to go back to the beginning to get some perspective because you sort of just jumped into, you know, where you started working. But there are a lot of people, some have children, some are the children, who would like to know how you did it. How did you get these gigs that you have, and what were they? What were the first ones, and can you remember how you got your break?
You know, like majority of photographers then and even today, it was difficult going, definitely, you know, hungry and aching and wanting to express yourself and work. There was a photo agency in Milan at the time, and I think he's still around, Giorgio Raposi. And I went into his office one day and I said, I want you to represent me. This is in the fashion side. This is my past life. And amazingly, I forget the name of the editor, but the editor of Interview Magazine was there visiting from New York and saw my book. Just serendipity. And he saw my book and Raposi was there. And
book by book, you mean?
A portfolio. Portfolios, whatever. A book. Pictures.
Sure.
And it led very quickly to, if I can remember correctly, that, oh, we want to, let's do something with you. And then Raposi took me on, and I wouldn't say my career jettisoned, but it suddenly started to work. It helps to have an agent. Definitely then it helped to have an agent.
So what were some of the original major stories?
I did a lot of portraits for Interview, did a few assignments with Harper's Bazaar, Italy, Italia. It was a magazine called Vanity at the time.
Sure.
Terrible name when I think about it, which is absolutely everything I'm not into now. Called Vanity was more an art fashion magazine. And I wouldn't say I was working like crazy. I mean, I was still, you know, plodding through the mud. But I could see that if I really wanted to stick at it, when in hindsight, now I probably could have, you know, would have done, who knows, right? Who knows where the path of life goes. But there was a lot of these pieces of existence, of art, of my own or in any one of us, our collective function and flow in life, that events took place, like this trip to Tunisia, like this evening of sleeping on the streets in New York, that caught me, and I'm going to use it only for me. I mean, there's nothing wrong in art and fashion. I mean, I think it's limitlessly creative. It's wonderful in the sense of anything you imagine, you can achieve it and create it. But I just found it too simple over time and too self-absorbing. And I only say that now and probably then because, again, pieces were coming into my life, like all of us have in life, I'm not anything unique, that sort of shepherd you, that guide you. I wouldn't say I was a lost sheep or a cattle wandering in the desert, but events obviously had to happen in my life or obviously were meant to happen, who knows, that brought me out of an element that was of self-expression that I found intriguing and, of course, I respect. But that brought me to, for me, for how I feel in life, the expression that something is much more beyond me, and that is the enormity of humanity around me.
We're talking to John Stanmeyer. He is a noted photographer, works for National Geographic on assignment, and his stuff is incredible. John, how did you come to work for National Geographic?
You have to sort of go back now. How did I get out of this realm of...
I'm more than willing. Let's go there.
Yeah, how I got... So I get rejected from the Peace Corps, and I'm completely, you know, gutted, absolutely floored. And then I ended up buying an old sailboat, and I just was frustrated as can be, and I just wanted to sort of vanish. But an old 1927 wooden sailboat.
Mm.
Basically, I have a boat, and in this boat I have a hole, and in this hole I put all my money. And it was intriguing. But I needed again to sort of find myself. I'm probably in my mid-20s, early
How much was the boat?
Oh, I think it was only $10,000-$15,000.
A lot of money in those days.
It was, sure. But I wanted to just sort of vanish. And then my father was still alive, and he kept seeing this advertisement in the local paper in Florida called the Tampa Tribune. It was called Advertising for a Stringer. He didn't know what it was. He's a banker. He's a finance guy. He's already retired. He's like, John, you can go there and tie up photographs. I'm like, well, no, that's not what the job means as a stringer. You don't tie up photographs. It means you go do the work inevitably that nobody else on staff wants to do. And I said, no, you know, I don't want to do that. And it kept coming in the paper, and he kept mentioning it to me. Sort of, I would say, one of the key elements of shepherding. He said, John, you should just do it. Sort of to get him off my back, I went.
Stringer usually means part-time job.
Part-time job, right. And so I just went. And I never forget, I go to this office at the Tampa Tribune in Sebring, Florida. And I meet this lovely, kind, dear friend of mine, still a good friend, Colin Hackley, who's a staff photographer. And I show him my book. And he's like, I want to do what you're doing. Why are you coming here? Why do you want to do this? And I said, you know what? I actually want to. And I'll never forget the first assignment I did was to photograph a baseball game. And I don't follow sports at all. Yeah, yeah. I mean, when the Super Bowl's on, I'd rather watch a...
But it gives you a fresh eye.
I guess at the time it was a fish on dry land, Alan. I'm sitting there with a 50-millimeter lens as my longest lens, and I'm walking right up to the first base, not even knowing where I can be. I'm in the way of the baseball game. And I just laugh about it. No, it was just hilarious. But then I realized it clicked. I'm going to use the paper as a means to do the issues and passions that I'm deeply engaged in, or at least internally engaged in, and I'm actually going to use my camera.
Did they give you the choice at the paper to do what you wanted, or did you have to do what they wanted?
No, in the beginning, I was just a stringer, right?
Yeah.
Doing the work that the other photographers didn't want to do. And then I got an internship, which is kind of odd because I wasn't in college. They sort of brought me in. And then in a few months, I was staff. And I think this is crucial in journalism today, especially as newspapers are in a deep state of flux, and our whole industry is in a deep state of flux, where whenever the carnival would come to town, or these annual events that newspapers have to do, again, I was there and had a purpose. I knew I was not going to be there forever. I've worked in the freelance world my whole life. I think the only job I ever worked for anybody was at a fast food place when I was 15 years old. I'm sort of hardwired to work independently. But all the staff photographers, when the carnival comes to town, like, oh, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. Like, I'll do it. You know, next year comes along. Oh, I don't want to do it. I'll do it. Because they'd forgotten the magic. They'd forgotten to see the enormity of even the most subtlest things can be absolutely brilliant right in our own backyard. And so I used the paper like it used me. And I knew I wasn't going to be there forever. And I met my wife there, Anastasia. She was a writer. And we used to save our coins. And again, I was sort of hardwired, I think, to think globally. And yes, I hope act locally. And we had saved literally our coins. I do this today. My children do it now. I do it today. If I go and I buy a pack of bubble gum, and well, now bubble gum's quite expensive, but you buy a pack of gum and it's $1.10, I'll go hand $2 and I'll keep the change. And even if I got $5 and quarters and dimes and pennies in my pocket and I go get a soda and it's $1.05, I'll still hand $2. And that we would fund ourselves to go do stories around the world on our holidays using coins. And then we had this opportunity to bring these photographs and these stories back to a major metropolitan newspaper, and they would give us, never pay us, and to the chagrin and sometimes frustration of some of the other photographers, but I didn't care. The ability to communicate to 250,000 readers on a Sunday with a front page, double spread inside in color, and even a fourth jump page in black and white. And like, this is what it's about.
What were some of the papers?
I just only worked for the Tampa Tribune. It's the only newspaper I ever worked for.
Interesting.
And it was a staff of about, my goodness, about the old days. It's not even that long ago. I think there were almost 30 staff photographers at the time.
Whoa.
It's changed. It's now heavily on a television basis, but still publishes. But it was a great experience. I think I worked there for 5 or 6 years. And then I went back into the freelance world. And I connected with a photo agent because I know how the business
in
runs.
In the States?
In the States. Marcel Saba. He owned and had his own company called Saba Press Photos. Highly respected. Wonderful guy. And then I moved to Asia. My wife and I packed everything up.
What made you do that? And I want to remind everybody we're talking to John Stanmeyer, who's a noted and very successful photographer. And what made you go from Tampa area to Asia?
a myriad of things, but more so the intrigue of the region, the enormous changes that were taking place. We moved in 1996 to then British-controlled Hong Kong and was there for a year before the handover. A lot of historic events were taking place. It just felt right. It felt
were you
like
there during the handover?
Oh, yes, yeah.
And yes. Did you take pictures?
Yes, indeed. We moved in 96, and by the beginning of 98, I was put on contract with Time magazine. And mm-hmm. for a decade, I was on
really?
Contract with Time.
I'm sorry to be so nosy.
Sure.
But it's what I do.
Yeah, you're a journalist.
Can you make money doing that?
Then or now?
Then.
Oh, yes. What do you quantify as making money?
Well, how were you living?
We had an apartment, a simple apartment. Our first apartment we moved into was probably 200 square feet. You got off of the bed, you took two steps, you were at the kitchen, you took a step to the left, and you're in the bathroom. And so, you didn't complain.
So were you making $20,000 a year? Were you making $40,000 a year? What were you making?
My goodness, I was probably working 100 to 150 days a year for Time. So I wouldn't say six figures, but enough.
We're making enough money, and Time paid well.
Yeah, I mean, day rates were then, I think they were around 450 a day, 500 a day. They've gone up a little bit, not much. Our industry is still in a deep sense of economic pressure, of difficulty of how to, sustain publishing as ink on paper. I think there's limitless potential right now, but that's a whole other discussion and intriguing passion that we should be looking into. But
okay, so there you are. You're in British territory. This is about to change hands to the Chinese. You take pictures. You're on call from Time magazine. You're making a lot of money.
No, not a lot.
In those days, $500 was
yeah, but you didn't
money.
Work every day. You would work. I mean, the Hong Kong handover, I think I worked only 2 days a day, but maybe 3 days, a day before, the day of, and day after.
Yeah.
No, by no means. And no means do you make a lot of money in this business. If you want to make money, you don't do journalism. You just don't.
Okay, let's go back to the chronology. Time magazine. How did you get involved with National Geographic?
My goodness, years ago, at the paper, I was still working at the paper, and a friend of mine, a photographer named Ron Berard, knew then the deputy director of photography, the late Susan Smith, and I went up to see her. He was kind enough to connect
you
me
mean
to
at,
her.
At National Geographic?
Yeah, this is years ago. This is still while I'm at the paper, and I think he could see he was a very good friend. And I think he could, I don't know, I had to ask him, but I guess he could see that I was intrigued in deep, storytelling, let's say. And so I went to see Susan, and she was very, very kind. And then at the time, it was Tom Kennedy was the director of photography. And I'll never forget, he said, okay, I'd love to see you do a spec assignment. Come up with an idea, start photographing it, and then bring it back to us. Well, I did, and I went back to Florida, and I did this story on the Greek sponge divers in Tarpon Springs, Florida, which is a Greek community. Literally, it's like walking back in time or
terrific.
Walking to Greece. And I funded all myself, Kodachrome, and I remember even myself renting a helicopter to do an aerial.
Really?
Yeah, I saved my money. I'll eat rice. I'll just eat rice. It doesn't matter. And then I remember right when I near the completion of it, I go up to see Tom with it, and it was his last week at the magazine. He was leaving, and here I was putting this together, and my connection was sort of walking out the door. And that's fine. It was great, wonderful people, but Tom left. And there's sort of a change of, not change of guard, but a change of role. And you have to get to know these people. And so it was a few years later, and then a new director of photography, Kent Koberstein, lovely guy, very talented. I think over a period of time, we just started to connect. And then it was the tsunami of 2004. And I got a phone call while I was up in Aceh in Sumatra, working for Time, and I got a phone call. He says, John, I want you to do a story on global aid, how the aid industry runs around the world, starting from the vantage point of what happens when a monumental natural disaster like the earth moving, burping, erupting, can change society in many ways, alter humanity's existence in certain areas. And how does the aid community work in such unique situations? And so that started with my first story for the magazine about 10 years ago, nearly 10 years ago.
Now, how do they pay?
They pay all right. I mean, not astronomical. I mean, because
I keep asking you this, because when I go into your shop in West Stockbridge, when you're not on assignment and you're mm-hmm. there, I look around, and it has the trappings of your being a wealthy man.
Oh, gosh, so, I hope
so,
it doesn't.
Well, it does. So how did you get there is the question.
Wow. Well, that...
Because I keep asking you what these stories pay. I'm always surprised when I ask visiting folks what something costs. If you write a single article for the New York Magazine or for the New York Times, mm-hmm. what you get for it. Because I think if you're sitting on the other side of the radio, you're astounded by some of the prices that one gets for an article in either of those.
What do they get for an article?
Well, I don't really know, but we're talking about thousands of dollars.
A day rate varies with everyone, but about 600 a day, 500 to 600 a day.
For National Geographic?
For National Geographic. But, okay. but you're not working every day, so it sounds great. It may seem unbelievable.
So how did you get to at least appear so wealthy?
I think when you walk into the gallery in the coffee house in West Stockbridge, you're seeing a personal collection of items that I've collected over 20 years.
Right.
If you walk in, there's a Javanese bench. It looks antique. It is antique. If you bought it, you know, in Great Barrington at Asia Barong, it's probably going to cost you $2,000-$3,000. Go live in Indonesia and buy it 10 years ago, and it's $125. Mm-hmm. You know, go to IKEA, you'll spend more on that on a sofa that's going to rip apart in a month than you are an 80-year-old wooden, bench. So,
well, not to prolong this. I want to go back to your chronology, but to the narrative, as we say. But
I will tell you this. Yeah. What we do in West Stockbridge, there is a financial risk. We leveraged our home on it.
But your wife also publishes a very good, glossy magazine. They mm-hmm. ain't cheap. Berkshire Magazine. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you've done something to do all right.
I guess. I mean, she's not paid hand over fist for that. I mean, it's the magazine. I can't speak for her, but I think it's only published 8 to 9 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. She's the editor, incredibly talented at it. She chooses all the stories and has to, if she even plays at times photo editor. But I wouldn't at all say that what we're doing is anything unusual other than I'll tell you this, Alan. There's an agenda that's going on in my coffee house. There's no question. And the agenda is I want to make people think. And we had a gallery in Indonesia I shared with a painter. And it was quite interesting. Went well. But I legally couldn't do much about it because I was in Indonesia on a journalist visa. So I couldn't do much interaction with it other than show work, which was important to me. And then when we moved to the Berkshires 5 years ago, we chose a property that has a large barn specifically for the gallery because I want to leverage visual communication to take it beyond what I do for these magazines. Because Time Magazine, it's incredible. You get to communicate with many, many people, but it's gone a week later. National Geographic is one of the longest shelf life, a month, reaches 10 million readers, 7 million subscribers, 20, 30 million eyeballs around the world. I'm incredibly grateful and thankful for that power of communication, but then it vanishes too. And so the space of the gallery was to how to take and leverage issues that I'm passionate with and share it in an educational way.
But a sustained way. In other words, if I'm following you, you're on a radio show now, people are going to hear it, thousands of people hear it, but then it's gone into the ether. Same thing with anybody who reads a magazine, maybe anybody who reads a book. But when you have your paintings, it's on the wall, is that what you're saying? And therefore, you're going to think about it all forever?
No. I hope I'm not taking too long here. But so with the gallery in the barn was interesting. We had it for 3 years right on the property. And every year we had about 300 to 500 people show up in a barn in the middle of nowhere in Otis, Massachusetts. And I thought, I got to do more than this. There's got to be more to it. We'd have events. I'd give lectures. And that was I love coffee. I have a passion for brilliant coffee. And we couldn't do it in the barn because of code reasons. And it would cost enormous amounts of money to put in a lift to get, for handicap access to the loft area, which is where the gallery was. And we made the leap of faith, an enormous, leap into going, I'm going to wrap the issues that I'm passionate about using photography, visual communications, around another thing I'm very passionate about, and that is brilliant, ethically procured cups of coffee. Because I'll tell you honestly, we don't sell a lot of photographs in the gallery. Not everybody's a collector. I get it. Not everybody collects reality and history. I get it. But if I can go and procure beans from the Congo, a country that's trying to come out of conflict, or Aceh, in northern Sumatra, where I'll literally go every month. I select beans that are coming from regions I either work in or countries that are coming out of conflict to try to help farmers economically empower themselves. You're going to come into that coffee house, and if I'm there, I'm going to tell you about it. Not because I want to depress you. I want to enlighten you and enrage you and be impassioned by this cup of coffee is actually empowering somebody to make a living. And there's some artwork on the wall here. And why don't you take a look? Why don't you see if it feels something for you so that you can, with me, collectively, you and all of us, can help turn the wheel of change, because I can't do it myself, because that magazine vanishes in a week, or it vanishes in a month, or this radio show's off the air and nobody's going to sit here and archive it and play it repeatedly over and over. Not at all. I learned long ago that I'll never change the world independently. And I don't think anybody can. You know, Mother Teresa didn't. Dalai Lama isn't, you know, universally changing the world. Nelson Mandela has done monumental impact, but we still have huge issues that I'm photographing repeatedly around the world. But collectively, I firmly believe we can. And so there is an absolute agenda going out in that coffee house. I'm
tell
not going
to
lie.
John Stanmeyer, tell me about the National Geographic series that you've been working on and that you're going to go back to working on.
This is a story that is called the Out of Eden Project. It's my friend and colleague's project, his own project, Paul Salopek. He is getting funding and support, of course, from National Geographic called Our Greatest Journey. And he is walking from a village in northern Ethiopia that we started on January 10th of this year. And he's walking for the next 7 years following humanity's migration out of Africa that began roughly about 60,000 years ago. And he's following the bone trail and the DNA trail of Homo sapien bones.
How does he know that?
Through science and through research, through academics.
So who does he work with?
How do you mean? Who does he work
with?
Well,
how does he work with? I mean, obviously, this involves working with a scientific community to find out what
He partnered up with Dr. Tim White out of Berkeley, our nation's probably most preeminent paleoanthropologist, and he partners with the Ethiopian government's archaeology and anthropology department. And if you look at the DNA record and also the carbon dating, our oldest human bones that are Homo sapiens, that are us, or same, you know, kneecap, or same elbow joints, those oldest bones, amazingly or ironically, are all start about 60,000 years ago in this village called Hertoburi. They're scattered along the surface of the ground and just very slightly under the ground.
And so how does it work? He's taking 7 years to walk it?
He's walking the migratory pattern of humanity's walking migration to fill up our planet as we are today. And we reach sort of not every corner of our planet, but he'll reach Tierra del Fuego at the tip of South America about 2021. Which is where our youngest bones are, that date about 7,000 years ago.
So you're going to walk across the ocean, that's, forgive me.
Well, when we reached Djibouti City back in March of this year, at the time, about 60,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, sea levels were different. There was a land bridge,
sure.
And we as humans walked across the Red Sea into present-day Yemen and present-day Saudi Arabia. And then he'll go probably again by boat. You'd have to ask him exactly how he's doing it.
But what does he do? What does he get for this? In other words, what's the insight that's provided by his taking the 7-year walk?
Slow journalism, slow connection to who we are as humans.
Mm-hmm.
A deep, deep, slow-paced interaction with really what we've sort of forgotten and lost in life when we're stuck in cars. I just drove here in, 45 minutes, less than an hour, and didn't interact with anyone except you on the radio and what you guys were talking about. Yet the world was all around me, and it just passed me by.
Okay, so now what's your role in this project?
My role is simply as the photographer.
You go back and forth while he's walking. I just want to get a picture of this. While he's walking his 7 years, every once in a while you'll join him and go somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. Paul is the official walker. It is his project. He, I guess you could say, sort of owns it or controls it. He's the Out of Eden walk gentleman, and National Geographic is one of the key supporters of this project.
Are you the only photographer on this?
At this point, yes. I don't know if that'll change. Who knows? This will be in about 10 days. I'll be reconnecting with Paul in southern Jordan. I was with him in Saudi Arabia last month.
You must have a lot of miles to trade in.
Yeah, but I never seem to be able to leverage them properly.
I can't either.
They're too convoluted nowadays
My son can. He goes everywhere for free. I'm looking at the front page of National Geographic for December 2013, and there he is leading a camel. You took this picture?
Yes. Yeah.
who decides that your picture, this particular picture, will be on the front page of this incredible magazine?
That's a good question. You have to talk to Chris Johns and Sarah Lean and others at the...
Do they get choices or do...
You know, there's a... I can send you a link. They were tweeting it right before the issue came out earlier in late November. There were actually four different cover options, and I wasn't aware of any of this. National Geographic is actually very unique. It's the only magazine that still functions a bit like Life magazine used to, where the photographer is involved in the edits, is even involved in the layout. So for this Out of Eden project, or Our Greatest Journey, after the assignment, you fly to Washington, D.C. You make the edit with incredibly talented editors. I'm working with Kim Hubbard on this project. She's phenomenal. We make the edit. We do a presentation. I look at every Geographic story like a doctoral thesis. You have to prove or present what you did research on.
Well, to give us the human side of this, there you are taking a picture of the guy walking across the desert with a camel. Mm-hmm. Anything ever happen? Did you ever get bit by a snake? I mean, did anything ever happen that we might find fascinating in terms of your taking this huge assignment on?
Oh, my God, there's so many things, Alan,
well,
that take place.
The
extreme lack of access to water and not being able to bathe for over 2 weeks or even change clothing. Even underwear for 2 weeks, because I travel very, very minimally. And actually what I learned out of that is that our bodies self-clean.
Except when you get a fungal infection.
Well, that would be an issue indeed. But no, reality was, I wrote a long blog about it on my blog, that I had dirt marks on my arm one day from changing a tire that had broken on the car. And about 4 days later, the sweat from my skin had naturally removed that stain of dirt. And I noticed it was the Afars that were around me, the Afar nomads. They didn't smell, and yet I never saw them bathing. And then I realized, wait a second, the only thing that's smelling on me is my clothing. It's the clothing that seems to retain your scent. And maybe that's not intriguing enough for your question, but that I found to be quite interesting.
Well, did anybody ever try to rob you while you were...
No. I was detained in a village by the local police, who was unhappy. This is in Ethiopia, unhappy that the name of his village was not clearly spelled out right on the appointment letter that allowed us to wander into very remote parts of Ethiopia.
But after how'd you get out of that?
A lot of talking, a lot of phone calls, and then he became quite friendly, which is the irony of how humans can be. We can put up big fronts and act with a lot of bravado and whatnot, and then we hopefully can humanize things.
Well, I'm sorry to say this to you, John Stanmeyer, but in many ways, you're a rock star. I mean, you are. You're on the front covers of National Geographic magazine, all of these other major magazines. And how does that affect you? In other words, you know who you are. My wife certainly knows who you are, thinks you're terrific. What does all of that do to you or for you? Does it go to your head? What is it?
Alan, it doesn't do anything for me.
But you are a rock star.
No, I'm just a simple human being. I'm insignificant. The reason why these photographs feel something to you.
Yeah, and but think of all the people with all the cameras in the whole world.
Yeah, but you're going to have all the cameras you want.
And you're it.
No, there's a lot of incredibly talented photographers.
Yeah.
Look at that issue. Paul Nicklin's in there. Amazing photographer.
Is he on the front cover?
No, but he's had other covers too.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. Steve Winter, stuff on cougars. Phenomenal. These are deeply passionate, engaged photographers. But they're humans. And we have this honor. I see it as an honor, a privilege to be able to communicate with a major vehicle of communication, that being this amazing yellow-bordered magazine. You never know how long it'll last. You don't know if you'll work for them 10 years from now, a year from now. Who knows? The reality of that makes photography for me, and this is why I left fashion photography, and I never thought about it this way until right now, is that I controlled everything that I photographed back then doing fashion work. It was my controlling, my mechanism, what was in my mind that I wanted to achieve and see on film or in a print. The enormity that's taking place in reality photography, or what's seeing ink on paper in magazines like Time or National Geographic, is the enormity of the people that have, and the beauty of the people who have allowed me into their lives. And that's what makes the photograph. I'm doing nothing. I'm doing absolutely nothing. I am insignificant. And the enormity is the fellow human beings that have allowed me to photograph and document their humanity and our collective humanity.
Let me try it this way. Your father, the banker, great man, you loved him. But who's going to remember the bankers? people are going to remember you for a long time. Everybody who has a stack of National Geographics in their basement or in their home or sells them at antique fairs or the rest of it, you're there. You're going to Google you, and you're going to get a lot of Googles, a lot of results. How does that affect you?
I never thought about it, Alan. I don't even, it isn't even consequential.
It never occurred to you that that as a result you have made an imprint in this society?
Okay, I'll tell you what I hope it does. In fifth grade in the Bahamas, I had a teacher, good God, I can't remember her name now. Anyways, and there was a cover of National Geographic of a volcano erupting, and this, I forget their name, this husband and wife team that were volcanologists, and they ended up tragically dying in a pyroclastic flow in the Philippines decades later. But this image on the front of National Geographic of a man in a tin suit with this volcano erupting behind it inspired me to be passionate about the earth and the land around me and cultures. I don't remember that photographer's name at all, I don't really know, but it left an impression on me. And if anything, that I hope in this period of time that I get to exist and this privilege to be able to work for a magazine like National Geographic, that it inspires children, that it inspires you and me, inspires my children. And that's all I can do. And that's my only purpose. That's my only interest. It's not about me. It's about these elements that are all around us that I'm incredibly fascinated by, and I think all of us are, or I hope we should be, or we should be, or to try to be inspired, because this is our only place we can live. This is it. We're 7 billion people. We're going to be 9 billion people soon. We need to cherish what we have and be inspired by it and be passionate to take on the role for the next group of people who will be after us.
Are you ticked off about the way we're handling the Earth?
Oh, absolutely.
So is your point of view reflected in your photographs?
I'm sure it is.
Give us an example. Talk about one you may be proud of that you think makes the point.
I don't like any photograph I take because I photograph reality and most of it isn't really beautiful.
But is it insightful to the point where somebody will say, look at this, or as my friend Rick Smith always says, golly gee whiz, Martha, look at this, we are despoiling our world.
Absolutely. I see what you mean. But the picture, let's use this magazine issue because we can look at other stories and find similar examples, I guess. The poor gentleman that we came across in Artakoba, this lava field in Djibouti, is a poignant, tragic, horrific example of modern-day migration, of humanity's movement still out of the Great Rift Valley, no different than how we inevitably must have been walking out of Africa 60,000 years ago, competing for resources. Well, we're competing for resources today. Whether you're, going to another job across the other side of the country, you are trying to take advantage or trying to have a better life, competing in some regards for resources, for opportunity. Well, there are billions of us on our planet. There are 2 billion human beings, no different than you and I, that survive on $2 a day. 2 billion of us, $2 a day.
You show that in your photos?
I did a whole story on the food crisis, on what it affects, on how rising food prices affect us globally, on how we feed ourselves. So this gentleman lying in a lava field in Djibouti is another example of our collective humanity's dire reality that we are running out of opportunities and resources, or more so in this case, gentleman's case.
So what's the answer?
Opportunities, and you'll walk trying to reach someplace to have an opportunity.
So what's the answer? I mean,
gracious.
I look around. You chose to come to my beautiful Berkshires and live there. I'm delighted you're there. Makes us all richer. But I look around at these beautiful hills, and I see another house coming up.
Sure.
House. I keep thinking about wasp nests as they take over, a particular area.
Yeah, but that's population growth, too.
Right. So what's the answer? I mean, you're decrying it. But is there?
I'm decrying the fact that the division of rich and poor, in my opinion, is unbridgeable. Tragically unbridgeable. And when you see stories, just like last month, I was in Saudi Arabia in a hotel room, and that ship sank off of Malta with 60 people, I believe, drowning, or I can't remember the numbers. Just tragic. And here I am in the same area where the origins of some of those people may have walked through to seek a better life. No different than my mother left Austria after the war, or maybe my great-great-grandfather when they left Germany, or your ancestors that left somewhere else in Europe or the Middle East. We are still repeating the madness that we've been doing.
I believe you, but listen, John Stanmeyer, you can't get away with this. We're talking about...
You want me to give you an answer? Yeah. There is no answer.
Well, everybody comes
I don't
up
have
with an answer.
I don't have an answer.
Well, you're telling us what's wrong.
I can pontificate an answer, but I don't have the power to make, you know, the enormous monumental change. Politicians do.
Yeah, but your pictures are influencing those politicians. I hope so. Yeah, I hope. To what end? Do you have an end that you want to influence them towards?
Towards greater equality, towards lack of degradation of our environment. We're not going to stop development. What you're saying in the Berkshires is, you know, you're going to have more houses being built. That's just the reality by sheer population number. But the reality is that until everyone can afford to have a roof over their head, and this isn't an answer because I can't just pinpoint an answer. If I did, and if anybody ever did, I'd be astonished if they could. But the reality is that we have to work collectively to find a means to allow everyone to have a roof over their head, at least a meal or two in their stomachs a day, and to somehow bridge this tragically unbridgeable divide between rich and poor.
So a picture is worth a thousand words. Is that your picture that leads to those thousand words which you just articulated?
I don't know if it's a thousand words or maybe it's just one word. And if it's one word that somebody with greater power than I have, they can conjure up in their mind and then actually go and act upon, then I've done my job.
So you're a relatively young man. You've got this coffee house, and let me just describe how you get there. If you're coming from New York State, you go on Route 102, and as you turn the corner onto the main street of West Stockbridge, there is your coffee house. It's a yellow house, isn't it?
It's a yellow house.
Yellow house. Get out and talk to John Stanmeyer, who is, of course, he hates this stuff, but genius photographer who has been honored again and again by working for some of the greatest magazines in the world. And you talk to people. Do you ever feel, you know, why am I talking to this person?
No, not at all. No, I'm impassioned every time. I don't ask you to sit in the coffee house enough to ask everybody that walks out the door how much I may rant and rave with them. Passionately, I hope. But no, I don't mind pouring a cup of coffee. I love it. I love coffee. I'm drinking coffee right here with you.
Although it doesn't measure up.
No, I'll give you that. But it's better than Nescafe.
How long does it take to get the right palate, John Stanmeyer? At what point do you become as expert in coffee as some people are in wine? I say that because there are days I have a wonderful cup of coffee, and then all of a sudden I take a sniff of that coffee. I say, whoa, what an aroma that is. I've never smelled that before. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah. I would say it even goes more than that. It's the palate, it's the experience, it's the almost the chemical discharge in your mind and the palate dance of your mouth. Look, I'm not a roaster of coffee. I can barely boil an egg. But I know how to procure and prepare and present some of the finest cups of coffee.
Okay, very quickly, because we're running out of time.
Sure.
What's the best way to prepare a cup of coffee?
Start with astronomically brilliant beans, grind them properly, and watch your temperatures on how you pour the water through it, whether it's a pour-over or espresso machine or a French press or even a filter. It has to do with the brilliant beans, consistency of the grind, and very clean, pure water.
And how do we find all of this out?
How did I find this out?
How will we find out what you know?
On coffee? Well, come on in and I'll show you. I mean, it's really, really, it's not rocket science. If I can do it as a photographer, anybody can. I don't know how to make coffee, but I know how to get brilliant beans and to give you a great coffee experience.
What a fascinating hour. We've been speaking with renowned photographer John Stanmeyer. You can find out more and see John's work at www.johnstanmeyer.com. John, fortuitous meeting in the Berkshires. We love having you there. Thanks so much for honoring us with your presence. It's great that we could talk to you.
Alan, I'm honored. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.